Welcome back, baseball family. We are thrilled to bring you this interview. We have Keith O'Brien with us. He is author of Charlie Hustle, the new book on Pete Rose. The subtitle is The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. It's available now. How are you, Keith?
I'm great. How are you guys?
We're great.
We're ecstatic.
Yeah, awesome. We are.
Me too. Great to be
here. We're pumped to have you here. We, first of all, we love the book. Just absolutely have loved it. So thank you for doing everything that it took to write the book. We're writers. We get it. And the amount of research that went into this book is apparent based on the notes and acknowledgments and all the research that you've annotated very clearly. So our before we get into it,
We'll get into that later, but Brick, go ahead and start us.
Yeah. We're going to get you caught in a rundown like we do with all our guests. All right. First question, what is your quest?
Wow. I'm a big fan of quests. It's actually the topic of all my books is a quest. My quest is honestly just be a good person, be a good dad, be a good spouse.
That's awesome.
I think we can wrap it up, Brig. I think that's it.
That
was outstanding.
Align with that.
Okay, I have a hard-hitting follow-up question. What is your favorite color?
My favorite color is purple.
Oh yeah.
It's going to be more common. I've noticed.
I'm going hard at purple, guys. I'm doing it.
Love it.
Yeah, I love purple. If your favorite team was a beverage, your favorite Major League Baseball team was a beverage, what would they be? And who is your favorite team?
Well, yeah. Well, you know, I'm born and raised in Cincinnati. And so the Reds are still my favorite team. You know, in Cincinnati, if you're familiar with the city, there's a little place called United Dairy Farmers, UDF. And UDF is a place where you love to get a milkshake. And so I'll go milkshake.
Oh, nice.
Nice. I would have thought like something to do with Skyline Chili, but that's very obviously surface level of my understanding of Cincinnati. So
No. But there's not a particular drink at Skyline
Chili. Yeah. I don't know that I'd want to drink it. So that's a good point. All right. Next question. If baseball was an ice cream flavor, what would it be?
Wow, you guys have good questions. Well, baseball is, I think, still for me, you know, America. I would say then if it's going to be the American ice cream, you just have to go vanilla or chocolate. You'd have to go one of the standards, I think. That's what I think.
Yeah, I feel like that's a response we get a lot. We get a lot of it's vanilla. There's nothing wrong with it. It's really, really good, but it's the classic, right?
Yeah it wouldn't be like bubble gum ice cream. It wouldn't be, you know, it would have to be, I think, vanilla. Yeah. Although, you know, now that I'm thinking about it, maybe Rocky Road, because, you know, baseball is, I don't know, it's traveling on a rocky road, I would say, now.
It is right now for sure.
Yeah.
Certainly. And it's not the last time, it's not the first time, and it won't be the last time for sure.
Right.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah.
That's what your book's about, which I love. And then last question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Brad's favorite question.
Yeah. This is my tailor-made question.
Yeah.
Okay.
Brad always wants to ask people, do you think Babe Ruth is or is not overly romanticized?
Yeah. So it's like the old question, overrated, underrated, properly rated.
Right. Well, see, I don't want to say overrated, overly romanticized, right? I feel like there's a difference there.
Well, this answer maybe will help inform our conversation here today. And certainly informed my reporting in my book about Pete Rose. I think we overly romanticize lots of athletes. I think that's a problem that we have as Americans, as fans. We like to think that we know them, and we like to ascribe to them, you know, moral values and put them on pedestals. And, you know, at the end of the day, most of them are just really good at playing a kid's game, you know, and they have all the problems that anyone else has. So since that is just sort of my personal belief in general about athletes, I would say, yes, he's overly romanticized because nobody should be so romanticized in the ways we've done for Babe Ruth and many others. What do you think?
My man. Yeah.
Brad loved that.
Absolutely. My thing is that the only thing we have of Babe Ruth is the old-timey radio call. The man was 8 feet tall and bulletproof. See, and he hits the ball 700 feet, 700 miles, you know, whatever. And it's like, it's not really how it was, but that's how they were conveying the story. And you had writers who were possibly embellishing what they saw because they had never seen anything like it to that point.
Right.
That's all we have to go off of. So that's my big thing with Babe Ruth being overly romanticized. So, and I mean, I'm here for it because I'd do the same thing, right?
Right.
That's how I am with Ellie De La Cruz and Shohei Ohtani and all those guys. So I get it. But at the same time, though, we got to have a little bit more realistic scope on things, I feel like. So,
yeah. I mean, his numbers were so anomalous compared to the other guys he was playing with. You know, it would be like somebody coming in today and hitting, you know, 100 home runs, you know,
we would
go crazy for that today. If some player showed up and suddenly was hitting 100, right. So much more than anyone ever has, that would be a massive story. So, you know, his iconic status is earned, but I agree with you. You know, it's overly romanticized, overly inflated, for sure.
Fantastic. Let's take a quick break. When we get back, we're going to get into the book, Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. Welcome back, baseball family. So again, we have Keith O'Brien here with us. Again, the author of Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. Got it right here. You can get your copy on Amazon and really anywhere books are sold. Is that right?
Anywhere. Yeah.
Yeah. Anywhere. Awesome. And I would highly recommend it. And we're going to get into it and you'll find out why. So my first question for you, Keith, about this book, I'm curious how much like legwork it took to get this thing together, because it is thorough. There are a lot of extra notes, notations, everything that I was looking at the book. I was like, holy cow, this is huge. And then I was like, but the actual book itself is almost as big as the notes. So how much, like I said, how much legwork, how much research, and how long did it take to do all this?
Well, you know, about the notes, you know, I want to write a narrative. I want to tell a story and try to bring nonfiction, you know, to life in maybe a novelistic kind of way. And so, you know, but I do take my work seriously as a journalist, as a historian, and I think it's important to show your reader how you know something. And so, you know, that's in the notes in the back of the book. If you're curious how you know how I, you know, painted a particular scene, you can find out there. But in the meantime, I'm not going to gum up the narrative with things that are going to slow it down. I want people to read and keep reading. You know, it took, I started my research for this book in the summer of 2021. Started my first interviews in August of 2021. Wow. And, you know, obviously, so it's, you know, 2.5 years from then to now. That included, you know, hundreds of hours of interviews with former players, with former commissioners of baseball, the entire team of men who pursued Pete in 1989 for his gambling, interviews with three different men who placed his bets on baseball, and 27 hours of interviews with Pete Rose himself until, you know, ultimately he did stop calling me back. So a lot of interviews, but also a lot of court records and documents as well, you know, were used to tell the story.
You touched on the fact that it is narrative. There is narrative drive behind the story. It is a story. It's a hell of a story, actually. And I think it's a story that stands on its own, which you do a good job of bringing to life, because the language is lyrical, but it moves fast. It has a literary flair, but without the literary sort of morass of slow literary, like in your head kind of feel. So how do you bridge the gap? Like what, how did you approach making it fast, but literary?
Oh, you know, there are some things that were very intentional. The chapters are relatively short. You know, you're not going to find a 30 page chapter in this book. You know, some chapters are 3 pages, you know, and so I think doing something like that can help quicken the pace, make it feel like you're moving quickly. And, you know, in any book, you can get lost in the weeds. You know, you can go down roads you shouldn't be going down. You can go off on a tangent you shouldn't be, you know, pursuing. That's certainly true with this. I mean, P. Rose, you know, played in thousands of baseball games. You know, there are millions of moments and scenes you could reconstruct for the book. So I was very choosy, you know, and very judicious in what I was going to write about. You know, and so I'm not going to cover every game or even every game in a World Series. You know, we're gonna get to the good parts, so to speak. And more importantly than that, you know, any moment that I did spend time on in the book, a game, a scene, a play, it has to move the story forward. It has to say something about Pete Rose. It has to say something about, that season. It has to be crucial. Otherwise we're just skipping ahead. And you know, you can, you know, summarize the game by saying, you know, the Reds proceeded to lose the next two games, you know, at Fenway or whatever, you know, and that's it. And we just covered two World Series games. But it was a challenge. It was a challenge because as a baseball fan, and I am a fan, you know, there's so many great moments. And so, you know, it hurt sometimes to not write about a moment, but my goal is to further the story, and I have to stay true to that goal.
Well, and that's why I brought it up, because I want our listeners and our viewers to know that the book is fast. Like, it, don't be intimidated by it, because it goes quick and it is richly written. So thanks for informing us on that.
Yeah, it really does. Well, awesome. One of the things, like you talk about the narrative, one of the things early on that Brig pointed out to me was, he's like, I would love to see this put together in like a kind of like a cinematic docuseries, kind of like Band of Brothers. Yeah. He's like, because I want to see that scene where Pete Rose is getting the crap beat out of him in that boxing match and see him get up.
Yep.
You know, stuff like that. Like your description, the way that you tell the story of how these things are going on, how these things are happening and unfolding, that it's just like, man, I could picture it in my head because of the way you describe it. And is that how you write that? Like, cause that's the way I do it, as I picture a scene. And then as it unfolds, I kind of describe it on paper. Is that how you do it? Or do you have a different method to your madness?
No. Yeah. So knowing what scenes are important is crucial. You know, then doing all the reporting you can for a scene is crucial. That's something I actually haven't thought about, the boxing scene. You're right. That would be so cinematic. And it's funny. I never thought about it like that until you said it. But you know, that old armory that Pete was fighting in as a 16-year-old, you know, was just a classic sort of brick, you know, structure. It would have been dark in there. It would have been smoky in there. It would have been wild in there.
Yeah.
And yeah, to imagine this young Pete Rose, you know, getting beat up in the ring, but refusing to go down and taking that away from that fight, I think is a powerful scene. It also is a scene that, you know, Pete Rose has used to sort of gild the edges of his mythology, and Pete's really good at gilding the edges of his mythology. You know, he can turn you know, a low point into a high point by saying, well, but what that shows is that I didn't quit. I didn't go down. And there's some truth in that, not to diminish Pete Rose. There's some truth in that, but he is really good at burnishing the mythology, and the press certainly helped a lot over the years too.
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. That was my next question, was how do you work with somebody who is inherently biased? I won't call him unreliable, but there's
borderline, inherent... right?
What?
But borderline, right?
Yeah, he has an agenda, and his message is to, you know, paint himself in the best light possible. And I'm sure that those associated with him, there was more of that happening. So what do you do with that? How have you, in this book, bridged the gap between those gilded edges and the truth?
Well, let me say something. I do think Pete is an unreliable narrator of his own story.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't say that as to be insulting. I just mean, this is a man who for 15 years, you know, lied and lied and lied about what happened. And I think in some ways is still diminishing what happened. So he is an unreliable narrator. I think most people are unreliable narrators. I think famous people in particular are. You know, if you are someone who's been interviewed thousands of times, you tend to go back to the same stories and the same version of that story. And so one of the challenges I presented for myself in interviewing Pete Rose was, let's go outside the lines. You know what I mean? I know the story he's going to tell me about, say, you know, the fight when he was a 16-year-old boy, or the 1970 All-Star Game slamming into Ray Fosse, or 1989 and the gambling allegations. You know, he's given enough interviews over the years. He's also written enough memoirs that I know what he's going to say. So, you know, one thing I was trying to do is to expand that a little bit. And, you know, sometimes the best questions to do that are just the shortest questions, you know, like, what do you mean? Or why? Or what happened next? You know, it's just short follow-ups. But getting to the why was really important. And that was part of my original pitch to Pete, that, you know, he's in his early 80s now. This is a time for reckoning, and that, you know, not everyone will support him. Not everyone will believe him potentially. But if he were to be vulnerable, if he were to let people into his darkness, maybe people would understand more. Maybe all of us would understand more. And that was part of my original pitch to Pete Rose.
Wow. That's awesome.
Yeah.
How many of the people you interviewed did you find reluctant?
It varied. Some people were thrilled to talk, and it was like they had been waiting for someone to call. You know, but yeah, a lot of people were reluctant. There's a lot of pain in the Pete Rose story. You know, if you cross paths with Pete Rose in a significant way, especially at the peak of his fame, 60s, 70s, and 80s, there is often a game, a play, an argument, a night that defines you 35, 40, 50 years later. Not just that defines Pete Rose, it's like if you got tangled up in that, you were often defined by that moment too. Wow. And those people still carry that with them. And so, you know, there was pain and, you know, reluctance at times to talk. And I have to say, you know, one thing I had going in my favor was, you know, this was a book. It wasn't a magazine story. I wasn't going to be working on it for 3 weeks. You know, I was doing reporting for like a year and a half, and there were several times where someone called me back months later, and wow. And finally ready to talk.
Wow.
Was there,
and you got to be ready on the ball.
So was there anything in particular that was like the most shocking revelation to you that you learned when talking to these people, or even talking to Pete in particular? Is there anything that was just like, whoa, never heard that one before. That's crazy.
There were lots of surprising moments, lots of things that are in this book that have never been written about before. So it's hard to summarize it in a sentence, but I think a lot of the stuff around the gambling is important and new. Pete Rose doesn't get in trouble in 1989 for something that happens the year before or something that happened 6 weeks earlier. This is like a freight train a-coming, and it's coming for 20 years. And so one of the things I wanted to do was go back and, you know, construct how, you know, his first bets with bookies and what that felt like for him, why he liked it, who those guys were, what he got out of that. And when you do that, you see that, you know, there are concerns about Pete Rose's gambling or his relationships as early as like 1975. Major League Baseball has concerns about his gambling as early as 1978. People in his inner circle are quite concerned by the mid 1980s, and no one can stop him from gambling anymore. And you know, Pete Rose has earned all the criticism that he gets, you know, in particular for his lies, the lies that he told for many, many years. My book isn't about making a case for Pete Rose. It's not about making a case against Pete Rose. I'm writing this story, you know, without judgment. But I do think the addiction piece of this does matter. In 1989, the idea that someone was a gambling addict was pretty far outside the common understanding of addiction for the everyday person. You know, we knew about alcoholism, we knew about drug addiction, but to be a gambling addict, that was pretty out there. And I think it's changed, you know, and as we've legalized gambling across America, we have a totally new relationship with gambling, and the idea that someone could be addicted to gambling is very common today. And I do think Pete's addiction, and that's what I would call it, is part of what put him in the corner that he couldn't get out of. You know, what does an addict do when they're confronted with the truth or with that, you know, with the problems that they're creating? They diminish and deny. That is well known, and in medical journals, and this isn't part of the book, but did help inform my understanding, you know, in medical journals, time and again, there are two barriers to a gambling addict seeking help, not an alcoholic, not a drug addict, a gambling addict. And those two barriers are shame and indebtedness. Pete is not the kind of person who's going to be vulnerable enough to ever admit that he felt shame. But I can tell you by the mid 1980s, he was in debt to bookies. Some of those debts were large. And I do believe that he felt shame about that.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things that I've come to find over the last couple of years is that anybody who says that gambling can't be addictive or isn't addictive doesn't understand the drug that it can be. Right. And the other thing, like you talk about how Pete Rose wasn't going to have the shame, like anybody who plays a professional sport has such a massively inflated ego because there's a certain level you have to survive on the field. Right. Like I talked about this with Bryce Harper all the time. Like he's not a jerk. He's a really nice guy in real life, but man, he is the biggest jerk on the baseball field because he has to be. Right. Because of the expectations he had to be. And I'm sure Pete Rose is the same way. He had to be a jerk on the field. And I'm sure sometimes it carries over off the field to some degree with their personality. I'm sure that was probably part of the problem with his gambling addiction as well. Was that?
I agree. I think one key understanding for me that I came to early in my reporting is that Pete Rose succeeds as a player and fails as a man. For the same reasons, you know, he plays with that fury on the field. He goes to extremes. He will not be vulnerable on the field. He will not bend or break to anyone. And just as important, guys, Pete Rose is an eternal optimist, which was an asset.
Gotta be if you're gonna gamble.
Well, it was an asset to him as a player. You know, yeah. What's the line from Bull Durham? Don't think, it can only hurt the ball club, right?
Right.
Heroes is not thinking. You know, he believes all the time that he's going to succeed. He is, you know, that confidence boarding on arrogance is an asset to him as a player. But all those things, his unwillingness to be vulnerable, his unwillingness to bend, his enduring belief that he will prevail, he will get out of this, are the same reasons why he's going to go down for his gambling. The same exact reasons.
Wow. So I thought that the release of this book was unfortunately very timely, given the Shohei Ohtani gambling.
Fortunately, scandal. Unfortunate.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it could
really help.
It helps the sales for sure. I'm sure it does. But can you give us your opinion on the Ohtani thing?
Yeah. My gosh. You know, we timed it to come out, of course, around opening day. So that was intentional. And, you know, no one would have ever predicted that we would have come out right in the teeth of what is undeniably baseball's biggest gambling scandal since the Pete Rose scandal. But in other ways, it's not that surprising. You know, in one of my first interviews almost 3 years ago with a man you guys will remember, and a man many of your viewers and listeners will remember, was with Faye Vincent, the deputy commissioner of baseball under Bart Giamatti in 1989. And then the commissioner of baseball who succeeds Giamatti. And in one of those very first interviews at the time, in late 2021, Faye was looking out over the landscape of how the world had changed and the legalization of gambling, baseball's partnerships with legal gambling platforms. And Faye said that, you know, there's going to be more Pete Roses and there's going to be more corruption. It's only a matter of time. And as soon as the Shohei scandal broke and the controversy broke, that was the first thing I thought of, that line that Faye had effectively predicted, you know, something like this. And, you know, let's be, you know, upfront. We don't know what we don't know about Shohei Ohtani and his now former interpreter and an alleged legal bookie and alleged payments, you know, of millions of dollars to covering gambling debts. We have no idea, honestly. But there are some important parallels here. You know, Pete Rose gets in trouble in the 80s, not for something he's doing initially, but for something the men around him are doing. Mm-hmm. You know, he has an inner circle of guys who are engaging in all kinds of behavior that attracts the attention of federal authorities in Cincinnati, the FBI. And just as there's a federal investigation happening in Southern California right now, there was a federal investigation in Ohio. And one by one, these men in Ohio start to turn on each other and they start to talk. And that talk and those turns gets the attention of the press who starts to write about it. And that forces Major League Baseball's hand and they have to investigate. So, you know, the circumstances are 100% different and we don't know what we don't know. But there's a lot of familiarities there. You know, there is a federal investigation in Southern California right now, and the press is digging into it. And that has forced Major League Baseball's hand. And it's just going to be very interesting to see what happens next now. You know, what is our appetite for a gambling investigation in 2024? You know, is Major League Baseball going to go to the mat on this in the way they did in 1989? There is so much that we don't know, but there's a lot that's out of baseball's hands. You know, one of the key things that happened in 89 was the bookie in question gets in federal trouble, faces federal charges, and decides to say everything, talk to everybody, tell everything. And, you know, something like that happened here again. Major League Baseball loses control of this narrative, and so too does Shohei Ohtani and his former interpreter.
Yeah, it's going to be crazy to watch this thing unfold with the investigation that's going. Okay, last thing we have for you. Pete Rose has a lifetime ban from baseball, which in turn, lifetime ban from the Hall of Fame. Do you think he gets in posthumously? Do you think he gets in after he dies, or is it going to be forever and ever, no Pete Rose in the Hall? No plaque.
Yeah. So if I'm going to speculate here, just as a fan, I think, and if I had to to since we're talking about gambling, if I had to bet my house on it, I would bet no. I would bet that he never got in. And I'm not suggesting that that's what I personally believe should happen. I'm just saying, I wonder who will be advocating for him when he is gone. But one thing, you know, I think can, you know, move the needle in a different way. And I do think it's everything we just discussed. I think it is the current gambling landscape. I think it is potentially what happens in this investigation in California. I think it is the next scandal that's coming for the next player. One thing I can say, since the book has come out and I've met readers and fans in town after town, is that fans, you know, have a trouble reconciling the fact that Pete Rose is banned forever for gambling, and that gambling is now so prevalent and, in fact, encouraged now by baseball itself. Obviously, there's not an equality to both Pete's sins and the current landscape. And by that, I mean, right, a player would still be banned, right, if they did it. But fans have a problem with that. Fans I've met have a problem with the fact that they're watching these games and baseball's begging us to bet on them.
Yeah. And we even have people on YouTube who are like, well, why can't they bet on themselves to win? Why can't they bet on themselves for the over? It's like, no, because you're manipulating the outcome of the game by doing something. Like, you can't even go anywhere near it. And so, it's a whole thing, and it's crazy, because you get Pete Rose in, you got to get Shoeless Joe in, and then it's a whole thing, man. It's crazy. It's just nuts.
It is crazy. It's for 35 years, it's been the great late night sports bar debate. It remains the great late night sports bar debate. You know, people who argue their side feel it 100%. You know, no one is on the fence about Pete Rose.
And I will say, I experienced a little bit more nuance lately with the Ohtani thing, because I'm like, you can't kick Ohtani out regardless, you know?
Right.
It's crazy. So I can feel a little bit more of what people say with Pete Rose, seeing it, an investigation with Ohtani. So,
yeah, I can see the betrayal and the advocacy and both, like, the apologetics side. And it's all starting to become more relevant for us with the Ohtani thing. And thank you for helping us with your book, because now we have all of the nuance that we've missed for years.
Well,
and
thank you.
Yeah, it's fabulous. I wanted to tell everybody that not only can you get Keith's book at anywhere, but you can get a signed copy, right, from Water Street Bookstores. Did I see that right?
Yeah, Water Street Bookstore in Exeter, New Hampshire is my local independent bookseller. And, you know, I live just a short drive away, and I go in on a regular basis and sign books. If you want a signed copy, you're not going to find me out on the road. You can always order it through Water Street. You want a personal gift for your dad or your brother or your grandfather or your son, just note in the sales form how you want it inscribed, and I'll do that. And then Water Street will ship it out to you. It'll arrive like magic.
Yeah, magic. we say automagically. Awesome. Well, Keith, thanks for being here with us. We appreciate it. And baseball family, we'll be right back.
Catch new episodes of the Baseball Together podcast every Tuesday.